Welcome once again to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and our guest today is Layla Mutin, because it, once again, it's time for Q&A with Layla. Layla, if you don't know, is the nutritionist at the Hoffman Center. She is a registered dietitian, and she has a master's degree in the field of nutrition. So together, on a weekly basis, we field questions from you. Say hi, Layla.
Hi, everybody.
And the way to get through to us is via radio program at AOL.com. Send us your questions, and we will endeavor to answer them via podcast. And an additional feature of the sending us your question will be that for a few weeks, we're going to be preempted on WOR in New York. So what that means is actually the program will be recorded anyway, but we need your questions to make the program work. And so in order to do that, you can call us from noon to 2 Eastern Standard Time on Saturdays. And the number is 888-302-3684. Write that down so that you can have it by your table from noon to 2 on Saturdays. By the way, the next few weeks we will be live, so you'll be able to hear us. But if you give us your number, give us a phone number, email it to a radio program at AOL.com with your questions, we'll use that number to call you during the time that we're not being recorded live on WOR, and we'll put you on the air and we'll answer your question, and then you can listen to the podcast or you can listen to the rebroadcast of the show, which will be Sundays from 11 to 12 on WOR Radio 710 AM in New York. So that sounds pretty complicated, that whole...
Maybe you want to repeat that number again.
Okay, it's 888-302-3684. That's our number. You can call us from anywhere in the United States. Noon to 2 Eastern Standard Time on a Saturday. And that's when we'll be there to answer your questions. All right. In the news this week, Layla, I just wanted to start off before we start fielding questions. Interesting article. You know, there's a biblical statement that the Lord, something to the effect, if I remember correctly, it's in the Bible. The Lord is slow to anger and is merciful, but it basically it says, if you screw up, the sins of the fathers shall be visited on the children unto the third and fourth generations. Now, that sounds pretty harsh.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? Wow. I mean, that's really Old Testament stuff. It's like, you know, everything's going to be copacetic, but if you screw up, not only are you going to get punished, but your offspring are going to get punished. And there's a scientific parallel to that in the news. It was from last month. There's a guy who his name is Dr. Skinner. And his first name is Michael. It's not the Skinner box guy from psychology. You know, we got the rats to press the levers. He's another guy who's hanging out with rats doing experiments. And what he found is that if you expose rats to some of the environmental chemicals that we're exposed to in our daily lives, that, as we might expect, the animals had problems. They had abnormally, the males had abnormally low sperm counts.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the scary part. That effect lasted for up to 4 to 5 generations.
Wow.
Of the offspring of mothers exposed to a chemical. So, you know, if you ask Charles Darwin about that, he'd say, that's crazy, because we believe in natural selection. And there was this guy who was competing with Darwin in evolutionary biology. His name was Lamarck. And one of his illustrations was that giraffes got longer necks because every generation of giraffe had to stretch the neck longer and longer to reach the delicious succulent leaves at the top of the tree. And that got inherited because they sort of almost acquired it from the environment.
Yeah. Natural selection, yes.
But it wasn't natural selection because Darwin would say, nah, that's BS, because the ones that didn't have long necks would die and the ones that had long necks would survive. That's natural selection.
Yeah.
But Lamarck believed that you could induce these changes. The environment would cause these changes. So there was a whole thing in Russia for a while where in Russia they had some very weird stuff going on during the communist revolution. They had some guy, I forget his name, he was a Russian biologist who practically was responsible for the deaths of tens of millions of Russians because he didn't believe in Darwin, he believed that you could actually condition grains to survive in harsh climates like, you know, corn, barley, wheat, mm-hmm. by exposing them to harsh temperatures. He said, if we just grow these things in Siberia, they'll take hold. And his name was Lysenko. Uh-huh. I think his name was Lysenko. Uh-huh. Lysenko was his name. This comes back to me. And his theory was referred to as Lysenkism. And what the link is that we tend not to believe that the environment can shape future generations. The environment shapes you, mm-hmm. but either you live or die, this natural selection. But actually, without natural selection operating, something screwed up the genes of these animals, changed them so that they had problems later on. It's really scary because, you know, this really increases our concern over environmental chemicals and toxins.
Sure, sure. Epigenetics. Speaking of rats, one scurried across the platform at 28th Street the other day. All of us jumped. You wonder.
I was going to say, as you were saying that, you looked around the office. I was saying, you know, I hope we don't have a problem here. People saw us sitting in our cold costumes in the office, and they thought that's a cute picture. But you know, they started feeling sorry for Dr. Hoffman because he can't pay his heating bills. No, it's like no, that was a goof, folks. And no, we do not. Now people are going to say, my goodness, I'm not going to go to that office because now he has rats in his office. Okay. We have no pest problems here.
Nope.
Okay. But anyway, just an interesting aside is that, a lot of people are against government regulation. And I got to say, too much government regulation. You can't get anything done in America anymore. It's really a deterrent to commerce. But man, when it comes to environmental protection, mm-hmm. we got to be really careful because look at what happens. You're not just affecting yourself or your children, but many generations
right.
going forward, and who knows what horrible consequences it's going to have. And I predict, you know, a lot of people are worried about China. China is our biggest competitor in the world, and China
yeah.
is going to catch up to America, and they'll eclipse us.
But you can't breathe the air there.
You can't breathe the air there. So how are they going to handle the enormous burden of the health problems that they're going to create for themselves?
Yes.
How are they going to sustain productivity over there? How are they going to keep their populace from rioting in the streets under mm-hmm. circumstances where you can't go out anymore? I mean, they have a very docile population. People, they say, stay home, don't breathe the air, children don't play in the street, wear a mask when you go outside. Mm-hmm. But how long will the Chinese be able to withstand that?
It's terrible. It's terrible.
And they also, interesting, they just have this thing now. One of the reasons why the stock market's going down is because the Chinese growth is decreasing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're worried, well, China's not like an engine of growth. It was growing like 10-12% every year. That was like leading the world economy. They were tremendously productive. Their productivity is going down.
Yeah.
And it's deliberate because you have to slow down that rampant growth without any kind of environmental controls,
yeah.
Where they're pouring, you know, coal and all kinds of, you know, horrible diesel fumes into the air. It's a problem.
It is a problem.
So we have to, yeah. you know, balance productivity and growth with controls. Anyway, let's go to questions.
Ah, well, speaking of the air, we have a cue on O2 from Thomas.
Okay.
Dr. Hoffman, what is the minimum of what is the minimum oxygen does a person need? The minimum amount of oxygen. And what level do you think is dangerous? Thank
wow.
you. Yeah.
Well, you know, in a way that sounds like really a stupid question, but it's actually a very profound question. Because, you know, how much oxygen do you need? Well, pretty much your body will tell you how much you
right.
need.
Do you remember that song, Love is Like Oxygen? You get
right.
too much, you get too high, not enough, and you're going to die. That's what just brought that to mind.
Okay.
So that's about the level.
That's a great song lyric.
I forget who it's by, but yeah. it's quite old.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what. But so the point is, well, let's take a look at that question. You know, first of all, the body has really great regulatory mechanisms to make sure that you take in the right amount of oxygen. So unconsciously, you breathe more rapidly or more slowly in response to the need for oxygen, whether you exercise or whether you're at altitude or if you have lung disease. And then another factor, of course, is whether you have to expel carbon dioxide, which is the waste product. So it's sort of your breathing rhythm is exquisitely attuned to your levels of oxygen and your levels of carbon dioxide waste product. So usually that's not a problem. There are some disorders of breathing mm-hmm. where people lose the ability to self-regulate, and it's actually a condition called Ondine's curse. Ondine, if you go back to Greek mythology, was a mortal mm-hmm. who, you know, one of the worst things you can do as a mortal is to lust after or sleep with a god's mistress, because if you did that, the god would become super angry and punish you in a horrible way.
Okay.
So there are actually many stories in Greek mythology about the wrath of the gods towards mortals who were so presumptuous as to lust after the god's main squeeze. So this Ondine apparently did this. I don't know if he was caught in flagrante delicto or whether he just simply lusted after some goddess or whatever. He was punished by the god removing his natural inclination to breathe so that he had to remember to breathe, so that if he couldn't rest ever because he had to consciously breathe. Now, the modern parallel of that...
That's anxiety.
Well, there's a major anxiety component.
Yeah.
And there actually is a modern equivalent. There are some people who feel breathless all the time, and there's some dysregulation of their breathing apparatus, and it may be psychological and it may be physical. It actually sometimes damage to the phrenic nerve that handles the diaphragm, or there's some damage to the autonomic nervous system that helps to monitor oxygen levels, and so it's a medical problem.
Do they tend to hyperventilate, or they just
they hyper and hypoventilate? Mm-hmm. They have Some people out there have this perception, and I find that there's actually a nutritional reason for that. It's low magnesium. Magnesium will give you sometimes a sense of breathlessness, which is akin to anxiety. I mean, anxiety is often a cause of breathlessness. So the answer is to teach people breathing techniques, deep breathing techniques, yogic breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, but also to give magnesium.
Absolutely. Magnesium is responsible, among other things, for smooth muscle contraction. That's your exhale, your inhale, all of that. So anybody who's low in magnesium. By the way, what wipes out magnesium? Stress.
Yes.
Having mitral valve prolapse.
Yes.
Can wipe out magnesium, a high sugar diet. So
And many medications, diuretics in particular. Yeah.
And dehydration, certainly, because it's an electrolyte.
Okay, so let's look at the other flip side of the coin is, you know, what's the problem with too much oxygen? Well, when I was in California a few years back, there was this great craze. I think it's over. I think it's a sort of a boom-bust thing where they have oxygen bars.
I heard about that.
And you would go in and you would breathe scented oxygen. And I guess that would help you party more hardy, or maybe it went well with the...
Or make you a little high.
I don't even know. I mean, I don't know how high oxygen is going to make you. Mm. But the thought was that this is going to somehow be good, because if a little is good, more is better. Well, under that principle, a lot of the folks who are walking around in my generation who are blind were blinded by oxygen. There was this trend in the 1950s to give premature babies oxygen at high concentrations. It makes sense because they had respiratory problems and you wanted it. So what they did is they gave them 100% oxygen, and they developed a condition called retrolental fibroplasia, which is damage to the eye that's permanent, and it is from oxygen at high levels. So too much oxygen, you know, like love. What was the song lyric again?
Love is like oxygen. You get too much, you get too high, not enough, and you're going to die.
too much, and you'll go blind. You know, love is blind.
Love is blind.
But oxygen is, you know, it's oxidizing. It actually promotes and affects cellular rust
oxidation.
And damage.
Free radicals combat oxidation.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was like a free radical attack from too much oxygen. So the other thing is, let's look at sports. I mean, you got like the Denver Broncos, right? And
Poor Denver Broncos.
Maybe the problem was that they played at sea level because they're used to being at the Mile High Stadium in Denver.
Right.
But you know, there's this whole thing in football of like, you know, you'd be running, you know, doing a lot of pass plays, and then you run in and the coach would give you or the trainer would give you oxygen. They don't do that anymore because it was one of those things that was clearly a placebo, because you don't really need to breathe oxygen even at the Mile High Stadium. It's not going to do any good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not actually going to help you recover faster. You just have to recover. You breathe faster and, you know, you exchange air.
Mm-hmm.
And breathing oxygen isn't going to help. Unless you have lung disease, you have a serious lung disease, then you're going to, then you're going to need oxygen. So an athlete doesn't need really oxygen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not going to help. The other thing I was going to say about that is that... what was I going to say? There's an opposite training effect, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Is if you want to become a good athlete, you go to Colorado Springs, where they have a United States Olympic training facility, which is at altitude, because you'll feel so much better and you'll perform so much better when you go back down to sea level. Because if you ever been to high altitude ski resort, or if you've been up to Lake Tahoe, which is at altitude, or for some people even Denver will do the trick.
Mm-hmm.
And you try and jog or walk around, you'll feel short of breath. And so this is actually a training method, is oxygen deprivation.
So they can adapt to that level of
oxygen. And there's even, I mean, you go into you sleep in a tent where there's less oxygen. It's oxygen deprivation therapy. That sounds pretty unpleasant, but athletes will do anything to increase performance. Or there are even breathing devices that restrict your breathing somewhat, so that when you're working out, you're getting less air. Like they're sort of like air filters you put around your mouth, like masks, where you get less air, basically.
With a scuba diving tank where you're forced to breathe to suck in the oxygen.
Yeah, and it sounds barbaric and crazy, but you feel so much better. It's like, you know, when you stop banging your head against the wall, you feel better. You know, that's a good reason to bang your head against the wall. It feels so much better when you stop. So that oxygen deprivation is actually more beneficial to athletic performance, at least in the training phase.
I imagine then that people would build up a tolerance or not, where some people will get altitude sickness more, or whatever happens when they're oxygen deprived, you know, seeing in kind of one dimensional or losing that spatial ability that can happen with altitude sickness.
Well, you know, what happens with altitude sickness is there's a whole thing where fluid gets in your lungs and your brain swells, and there's actually...
We're talking about Mount Everest now. We're not necessarily...
Not even... There are some people who are what are called flatlanders. They really have problems even in relatively normal altitudes. Like, they'll go to Denver, they'll feel really lousy. And it's genetic.
I was going to say, is there a gene for that?
There's a genetic. It's genetic. And I actually know very healthy individuals, well-trained athletes, who they just don't have the ability to adapt. But it's genetic. Some people are okay with it. Some people are not. And an actual treatment for that is ginkgo biloba, because ginkgo biloba promotes circulation. And there may be some aspect of deoxygenation to the brain that triggers this. So ginkgo biloba, it was interesting because I first discovered this at a ski resort. I was up in the ski lodge, you know, kind of resting, unloosing my bindings. And I went to get, something to eat in the cafeteria, and they were selling ginkgo tea. And I was saying, well, what the heck? Is that to make you ski smarter? Because, you know, if you, like, forget, you don't memorize the trails, you know, you might get lost. Or is it for skiers with impending Alzheimer's disease? And no, actually, it was for altitude sickness.
Terrific. Wow.
Kind of interesting. All right, so we got a lot of mileage out of that question.
Yeah.
We thought, that's a dumb question? No, that was a good question.
That's a great question.
There's no such thing as a dumb question.
There you go, Thomas.
Yeah,
terrific.
Okay. So, okay, what else we got?
This is from Cheryl. This question is for Layla and Dr. Hoffman. Thank you to you both. I listen to your radio show and podcast constantly. I take many supplements as I have hypoglycemia and have been on a very strict low-carb diet for many years. How do I know if my vitamins and supplements are getting into my system and are bioavailable? Is there some type of test I can use? I've heard you could soak the pills in water to see if they dissolve.
Right. Yeah, I think that that's a very crude test. And actually, I was one of the first people to write a rebuttal of that test technique. It was used by, I think, some Consumer Reports type, I think Consumer Reports used this once. They said, look, you're not getting anything for your vitamins because we devised a test that replicates what digestion is like, and we put the tablets in there and they just sit there. So if you think you're getting your money's worth, you're not, because our tablets didn't dissolve. And my answer to that is, that's not really physiologic, because the acidity is very high in the stomach.
Absolutely.
Also, there's a lot of peristalsis. There's a lot of churning, and there's a mechanical action on the supplements. They do break down.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, I'll talk to some patients who say, I literally see the supplements coming out in my bowel movements unappetizingly. But that's a rare.
Yes.
And mostly people do break down their supplements. How do you know if you absorb? Well, I actually test for absorption. We actually had a patient really interesting the other day where we tested her for a bunch of things, mm-hmm. and we found that she was not absorbing many of her nutrients.
Yes.
So I used to test for a million different nutrients as if there was some rocket science that documented whether the nutrients were being absorbed or not. I have less faith in some of these blood tests now.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if someone has normal levels of vitamin B6.
Mm-hmm.
They have normal levels of vitamin B6 in their bloodstream. Does that mean that they should not get additional vitamin B6? Vitamin B6 is beneficial for many conditions.
Yes,
it's beneficial
absolutely.
For PMS, for example,
mm-hmm.
at higher levels than might be revealed in a blood test. So you don't have to be deficient to get a benefit.
Right.
So
I think a lot of people ask this question, too, because they see the color of their urine, and they're seeing maybe a little excess riboflavin.
Right. That whole argument of are you making expensive
urine?
Is it coming out? You know, that whole thing. And, you know, what I have to say about that is that, you know, if it were true that a good reason not to take vitamins is because so much is coming out, then we should all stop drinking water.
Oh.
Because
we'll
so much comes out.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, all of that water we're drinking, what a waste of time. We go to the bathroom and it goes out. So
exactly.
Why even bother to drink water?
Exactly. If we're digesting and absorbing properly, we are getting our nutrition that way. And I think another way to tell if you're absorbing your nutrition is, how are you feeling? Do you feel well? Are you tired? Are you fatigued? I mean, what's happening there? What are your bowel habits like as well, you know?
And we look at the skin, we look at the hair, we look at, you know, we listen to the history and, you know, there are tests, for example, for omega-3 fatty acids. We do testing for beta-carotene. We test for B12 using a B12 test, but also mm-hmm. a methylmalonic acid test.
Yeah.
Sometimes we do something called an ion test, which is a very sophisticated test. And
we even look at CoQ10 levels.
We look at CoQ10 levels, especially when people are taking statin drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But we absolutely test for vitamin D on almost everyone. That's very important. Mm-hmm. We test for iron levels. We look for ferritin. I mean, these are... When you start seeing a pattern, you see like a lot of nutrients low, then you can say, gee, that person really isn't absorbing efficiently.
I think one of our most important tests that you do is the ionized magnesium.
Oh, yeah.
And calcium. That's a fabulous test.
Because magnesium is so hard to absorb. It, you know, most magnesium goes out, it acts like a laxative. It just passes
mm-hmm.
right through you. It makes you go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like... milk of magnesia, you know,
yeah.
that's not the greatest source of magnesium hydroxide. It runs out of you, makes you
right.
go to the bathroom, but it
right.
doesn't get absorbed very well.
Exactly. I mean, there are certain types of magnesium we give for things like constipation. It would be magnesium citrate.
Right.
For the heart, magnesium taurate is a little better. For heart, mm-hmm. for mitral valve mm-hmm. prolapse, even for blood pressure. Glycinate, the glycinate form of magnesium, being good for muscle cramps, among other things.
Right.
I would think. And magnesium malate is the one that shouldn't give anybody the runs or a soft stool or anything like that.
Yeah, that's a very gentle
yeah.
magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this one's for you. Hi, Layla. My 13-year-old daughter has been struggling with excessive underarm sweating. She's applying clinical strength deodorant several times a day, but still sweats through her shirts. She's trying to stay hydrated throughout the day, but it doesn't seem to matter. All of the medical solutions seem so toxic. Is there anything you can suggest to help her get through this?
Wow.
Kindest regards, Laura. She doesn't even want to. She doesn't even want to hear my opinion. She wants to know what you think.
Of course, she does. She's probably sending her question to me to get to you.
Okay.
This is about hyperhidrosis. Poor thing, and she's 13.
Right.
So the hormones have to be raging.
Yes.
It's not helping things.
Yes.
May I just say about this clinical strength deodorant several times a day, but she still sweats. Deodorant is the stuff to take care of the odor, but antiperspirant is the stuff to stop the sweat.
Yes.
Having said this, and I know she's having a problem, I'm not a huge fan of antiperspirants.
Mm-hmm.
It's a route of detox.
Mm-hmm.
But, however, this is a problem.
This is a real huge social problem for a kid because they're so self-conscious.
For anybody.
Yeah, but, I mean, especially for a kid, I mean, but anyone. And this is a known medical condition. It's called hyperhidrosis. So, really, you're right. You have to distinguish between a deodorant versus an antiperspirant. Usually they're combined. An antiperspirant is usually aluminum hydroxide or aluminum chloride.
Mm-hmm.
These are agents that close the pores.
Yeah.
So, you know, the concern is, A, it's aluminum.
Absorb it through the skin.
And B, you absorb a lot of this stuff through the skin.
Yeah.
So, really, there is a concern that, especially in women where the underarms are actually in close proximity to the breasts, that some of the chemicals in there get into the breasts and may pose a problem.
There was a British study, I remember quoting it in one of our presentations, where so much of the breast cancer is found in the upper fifth quadrant, closest to the armpit.
Right.
So, but anyway, what do we do?
Well, if they need to do a study, you know what they need to do? They need to recruit 1,000 women, and they have to do this at probably about the age of 11, and they have to tell them for 20 years... 500 of them don't use deodorant, and the other 500 get to use deodorant. And they have to make sure that they comply. Absolutely don't use it. And then after 20 years, we can compare those cancer statistics.
Yeah.
Well, but I don't think we can get that study done.
No, I don't think so.
Because I don't think any woman would, you know, eschew the use of deodorant voluntarily for 20 years.
No. Right. I agree.
So what can you do? Well, you say the medical therapy seems so harsh. Actually, the correct medical therapy there are electronic devices called dryonic devices. They're actually applying electrical current. They close the pores somewhat. Are they effective? Maybe. They're kind of a nuisance. They're really not that good a solution. The more permanent solution is to do something called a sympathetectomy, which is a type of operation where literally you have to go in and cut the nerves that lead to the armpits.
Wow.
And it does work. It does actually reduce sweating. It can also be done to cut the nerves that lead to the hands when people have excessively sweaty hands.
We've had a couple of patients like that.
That's a terrible problem because, you know, you present yourself via your hands, and it's like you shake somebody's hands, and it's like a wet noodle.
Putting antiperspirant on their palms constantly.
Not good. So the sympathetectomy takes care of that. It's actually pretty revolutionary surgery. It does involve a small surgical incision. It's done laparoscopically with a tiny scope. And, sometimes I've said to patients, do that. You know, the other natural therapy that works or is said to work, I don't know if you have good experience with this, is to drink sage tea. Sage tea has a desiccating effect, somewhat a drying effect.
Well, you know, sage tea is supposed to be good for hot flashes. That could reduce sweating.
And it also makes you smarter because it's sage tea. No, but actually there is research on sage as something that seems to prevent dementia. Yeah.
Oh,
so
goodness.
It's not toxic. And, you know, I raise sage in my garden. It's a nice herb. It's a culinary herb. I really like to use it.
Wonderful for poultry.
Yes, great.
Yep.
All right. Have you ever seen a sweaty chicken after you put it on? I never. They never perspire. Even at 400 degrees, they don't. Okay. This one is from Alan. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I am a 67-year-old male with low testosterone. A few years ago, I took natural bioidentical testosterone, a rub-in cream, and my levels decreased. Can you discuss what might have happened? Also, what are your thoughts on taking DHEA supplementation to increase testosterone? That's DHEA, Alan. Okay, so here's the deal. Testosterone can be administered in various ways. It can be administered in pills, which I don't really think is such a good way to go because it has to go through the liver, which is not great for the liver.
Mm-hmm.
And It also can be administered via topical creams. Now there's advertising a chemical called Axiron, which goes in the armpit. Mm. And it also can be administered via injection. What happens when you give testosterone is there should be an increase if you give adequate testosterone. But sometimes there's a compensatory decrease in your body's own ability to produce testosterone. So what may happen is if you're not taking enough, or if you take it for a while and then stop, your body may not be producing, it may have had its ability to produce testosterone suppressed by feedback.
I would want to know if Alan is overweight.
Right.
You think he might be aromatizing?
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, we don't know some of these circumstances because sometimes the testosterone that you take gets basically soaked up by your fat and it hides in the fat. So it takes a lot of testosterone to make your testosterone go up. I find this in overweight men. Mm-hmm. In skinny men, it's much easier to restore their testosterone with a little bit of topical cream that they rub into their wrists or their elbows, the inner elbow crease where you bend your elbows, where I usually apply it. So this is, I'd have to know the circumstances of this, but I've seen it. I saw it actually with a guy who got testosterone injections and he ended up with lower testosterone after the injections. But with the injections, it's high a couple of days after the injection, but if you go too long between injections, it might get low, you know, a week and a half later before your next injection.
Right. It would be good to know his DHEA levels, too, because that's the substrate.
Well, here's the funny thing about DHEA. DHEA sometimes can raise your testosterone. But everybody's different, I've noticed, is that sometimes I say to men, look, your testosterone's a little low, but your DHEA is really low. So let's start with the DHEA. I'll give you the DHEA. Let's see if your testosterone comes up. DHEA goes up. Testosterone doesn't go up in some men. In some men, DHEA goes up and testosterone goes up because the DHEA sort of gets spilled over into the testosterone, gets synthesized into testosterone. It's not a reliable building block in every case. Similarly with women, some women who take just a little bit of DHEA, they get a lot of masculinizing effects because their testosterone goes up right away and they get like acne or they're unhappy, their hair is thinning. But the vast majority of women take DHEA and it just builds their DHEA. It does not affect their testosterone. So sometimes a backdoor to testosterone, sometimes not.
Okay. So everybody's different.
Yeah. And I've just learned that from bitter experience working with it.
Okay.
I got one from there's no name. Hello, my husband is one of many men dealing with prostate issues for roughly 10 years, maybe a little more. He's experienced pain in his lower back, trouble with urination, and pain with ejaculation, with pain radiating for hours after intercourse. Ooh, that's pretty unpleasant. When it began happening, he went to see a urologist and ran all sorts of tests with everything coming out okay. Doctor ended up telling him, go get some salt palmetto from the store, it might help. Well, that sounds like that doctor, you know, if it's a conventional doctor, he basically was saying, I can't help you. So now, in desperation, let's try nutrition. Needless to say, he's tried many varieties of salt palmetto, beta-sitosterols, multiple other tattered remedies with no relief. The side effects of basic medications such as Proscar and others are scary, and the hoped-for benefits don't really outweigh the negative impact. I've been scouring the web for any hope and came across excellent reviews of Curamin for its anti-inflammatory properties. I think that's a curcumin product. So here's the deal. I don't know what's going on with this guy.
So it's not just a matter of enlarged prostate, benign hyperplasia?
Sometimes there's an inflammation. And that's the problem, because in prostatitis, and itis is an inflammation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's an enlargement in hypertrophy, and sometimes there's a, it's almost like a neurological problem, or we call it a pelvic floor dysfunction, which is like a pain syndrome that is related to muscle spasm. So, you know, some people get migraines, and some people get tension headaches in their groin for some reason. There's a lot of nerves down there. So it all gets messed up. So this is a very challenging thing. Sometimes acupuncture helps. Sometimes pain medications of various kind help. Sometimes various types of physical therapy help. It's a challenging problem, so I'm not sure that Curamin is the answer. You know, prostatitis is still a clinical challenge, and it's a challenge to holistic doctors like myself. Sometimes a diet change makes an enormous difference.
Sure. Well, anything propagating inflammation in the body. If this man were an active cyclist, would you recommend that they not bicycle so much?
Well, there you go. I mean, that could be a mechanical thing, sure. Mm-hmm. And it short of cycling, I mean, a lot of men spend a lot of time sitting in their cars commuting. And that sometimes puts pressure on the prostate, or sitting in chairs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sitting in a chair doesn't bother me very much, but for some men, anatomically, that is a problem. So, yeah. You know, there's a lot of dimensions to this problem. I'm not sure that it's one of those things that can be addressed with a single supplement. But it's worth a try, and, you know, curcumin is one of my favorite supplements for inflammation.
What about an antibiotic?
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, you mentioned, you know, could it be infective? And this is the problem with prostatitis. It used to be treated always as an infection. And it is something that is very unresponsive to antibiotics for a couple of reasons. One is that mostly it's not an infection.
Okay.
Two is that if it is an infection, it's very hard to get the antibiotics deep into the prostate. So one of the treatments we'll use proteolytic enzymes like Wobenzyme. It's used a lot in Europe for inflammatory conditions. And even if you're taking an antibiotic, it helps the antibiotic get to where it needs to go. So tough kind of problem.
Yeah. Okay, best of luck with that. This is from Maria. Dr. Hoffman, what are your thoughts on drinking almond milk instead of dairy milk? Well, if you're allergic to dairy, I think almond milk is a good choice. I think unsweetened would be better.
Isn't almond milk often really laced with a lot of sugar, though?
It can be.
Yeah.
Is that
silk almond milk? No.
I think it's a combination. I really don't know because I don't drink these things myself anyway.
It looks like really like Benjamin Moore paint. It looks really appealing,
uh-huh.
You know. Like, but you could paint your room with it, you know, like latex.
It's a nice almond
color.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. No, almond milk, I don't have a problem with almond milk. There are lower-carb almond milks out there for people who need to watch that.
Right.
Not getting the vanilla flavor, not getting, you know, the additional sugar is a good idea.
Right.
And, of course, if you're allergic to dairy or if you're avoiding dairy for a myriad of other reasons, which is just fine because as human beings, we really don't need any dairy. So I don't have a problem with almond milk.
Mm-hmm. Well, but let's put it this way. Almonds, we know, are healthy, heart healthy, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
However, do you get the same benefits from drinking the almond milk as you do from eating whole almonds?
I don't know.
I would think not.
You don't
get as much fiber.
Right. And the fiber would be gone.
Right. And since it is processed, plus it's sort of anything that's liquid, you can guzzle it. Whereas, you know, eating almonds actually takes a little work. You have to chew them, and they have more satiety value.
The other thing is, when we process our food like this, some of the nutrition does degrade.
Yes.
It does diminish.
Yeah.
So I would say eat almonds, drink water.
Yes. There you go.
Or something like that. So that's fine.
What else we got?
That's fine. Let me see here.
This is the woman with this. There's a question from a woman with an issue related to female.
Yes. Let's call her Diane. This is not her name.
Okay.
Hello, Dr. Ron et al.
Okay.
This is a question or concern. It's too embarrassing to discuss on the air for me anyway. But if you could address it so I know that I'm not alone in this. I'm currently in the first year of menopause, meaning I have gone a year without any periods and am now moving into the first technical year of menopause. Over the past few years, my interest in sex has been declining, but at least when my husband and I were intimate with each other, I was able to achieve multiple orgasms. It was enjoyable and bonding. I did notice that I only felt like being intimate about one time a month. Now I'm getting so frustrated, not just because I don't have any desire at all, but it's the articles that I've read that ask if your sexual desire is weak or lower than it was. It's not only gone, but even if I try to do several things, you know, racy literature, toys, things like that, I cannot reach an orgasm at all. I did discuss this with my husband. I suggested that he continue to enjoy our time together as I would, but to understand that all that was going on with my hormones right now, I'm not quite there. And accept that for the time being, I may not be able to achieve orgasm. He does not want to be selfish and continue to have these intimate times when I'm not enjoying myself. Even though I've told him that I love the feeling of being close to him, I know that as a man, he really can't understand what I'm going through. Mm-hmm. A, I feel very guilty over not giving my husband the pleasure and times we used to have. B, I feel very alone in that my sexual interest has not lessened, but it has gone away. Emphasis right. on zero. C, I'm incredibly frustrated because I can't seem to find anything that helps with this. I'm taking oral progesterone, RX by her female gynecologist, along with the cream Estrace. I'm 55 years old, and my lack of desire actually makes me question my feelings sometimes. Is there any help out there?
Yeah.
Do you have any further suggestions?
That I think this is really an excellent email. And, you know, I think it really exemplifies a big, big problem because we have done more to improve men's sexuality by far than for women.
Right.
With men, we now have a whole raft of erectile dysfunction medications. We have injections that we can give. We have prosthetic devices that can give men erections, you know, all this stuff. That, because with men, it's more of a matter of if you can achieve the hydraulics. And, of course, we have a testosterone industry. I mean, it's a huge industry now. And, you know, we
low
now
T.
advertise on TV, low T. So for women, this is a huge, huge issue. And there are actually several candidate drugs that are coming on the market for women. It's actually, in women, it's called HSD, or hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Because you can't call it erectile dysfunction, because it's not. It's just hypoactive sexual desire disorder. And it a very high percentage of women are anorgasmic, we know that. But also a lot of women have a loss of interest in sex. And these, I mean, that in maybe the year 1900 or 1850, they were going to say, what's the big deal? But now we have, you know, the Kinsey Report and Masters and Johnson and, you know, everything's out there. And, you know, women want to be part of that. And also, you know, I think it's they want to have a balanced relationship.
Absolutely.
Because if their husband's libido exceeds theirs, you know, the whole concern is, you know, is the relationship going to fall apart? Because that important bonding aspect is going to not happen.
I think one of the things with menopause, though, besides diminishing estrogen progesterone, which she's taking oral progesterone, she's taking Estrace as well. What about her testosterone?
Exactly. This is something that can be done. However, testosterone was recently proposed as an FDA-approved medication for hypoactive sexual desire. It was rejected by the FDA. Now, that does not mean doctors can't prescribe it, but they can't come up with a drug that they can market on TV during a super, you know, part of a Super Bowl commercial saying, hey, women, if you have a lack of sexual interest, take so-and-so, take Climax, you know, because it wasn't approved. It did not actually have a robust enough effect in a double-blind placebo-controlled study, which, by the way, it has to be double-blind placebo because there's a lot of placebo, because if I say, hey, here's this thing that's really going to improve your sexual desire, you know,
right.
placebo effect is huge.
That's
so
true.
So
that's true.
Testosterone could be part of this. I noticed that her gynecologist gives her progesterone. Sometimes the if you don't use natural progesterone, you will get a real suppressive effect on libido. You know,
An oral progesterone, I imagine.
Right.
It,
So some new drugs are in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. The new drugs, what about using Viagra for women, you know, things like that? Actually, studies show that that doesn't do much. It may actually help a little bit with lubrication, but it doesn't do that much for women. It does more for men than for women. It certainly doesn't really increase sexual desire. It may help mechanical aspects of intercourse.
I do recall an episode of Sex and the City where Samantha was using Viagra and couldn't stop.
But that was Samantha.
But
Samantha was already, she was sort of a...
She's hypersexual.
She's on the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
She was a hypersexual character in that show. And so, you know, the other problem is I think women are under a great deal of pressure because they see shows like that and they think they should all be like sexual superstars.
Yeah.
And there's a wide spectrum of sexual response, and, you know, there's everything is normal.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, you know, how do we impact it in a positive way without medication? You know, things that can be helpful. I like maca for
mm-hmm.
women.
Mm-hmm.
Maca has been shown to be helpful. And we have, what is the one we have? Femessence.
Femessence
is the product that we use, and it has a nice effect. It's a gentle herb. It increases energy and stamina. Also, I find DHEA really helps women's libido.
Terrific.
And without the side effects that testosterone mm-hmm. Causes, and it's not doesn't require a prescription. The other thing that can be done is you can use, for women, instead of just using estrogen cream vaginally, you can use a little testosterone mixed with that estrogen, and it actually has a good effect locally. It's not like an instantaneous, you know,
right.
I feel sexy thing, but after a few weeks of application, there can be an increase in the sensitivity in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And not to mention that the estrogen helps to increase elasticity and makes it less painful to have sex, because you're having pain on intercourse. That's going to be a deterrent to having intercourse,
absolutely.
Right? Because, like,
yeah.
let's have yeah. sex. Like, that's going to be painful. That's not going to increase your desire to engage in that activity.
Absolutely.
So we use estriol vaginal cream. That is a type of the least harmful or dangerous form of estrogen. Works really well to restore elasticity.
Is that a bioidentical?
Bioidentical. Mm-hmm. Yep. But, you know, there are actually several drugs that will be introduced on the market, and it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the next decade or so as these drugs get introduced into the marketplace. Because, you know, Viagra had a real social impact.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see if there is a successful female drug, you know, what'll happen. Because it's really going to change women's lives, and it'll change relationships, and
sure.
it'll change, you know, our culture. But for now... it's HSD, hypoactive sexual desire disorder, and it's a big problem. So
yeah.
I thank you, whatever your name is, mm-hmm. we're going to keep it
we're
confidential.
We're calling her Diana. That's not
Diana
her name.
For bringing this issue to the fore, because for a lot of our listeners, this is an issue that is important. I think we have time for maybe we'll save additional questions, because that we spent a long time on that one, and we'll save a couple of questions for next week's edition of Q&A with Leda. What else do we have on the launch pad? We've got an upcoming seminar, right?
We have an upcoming seminar Wednesday, February 26th, The War Against Natural Medicine, which you and I will be co-presenting. So February 26th, Wednesday, from 6 to 8 p.m. Reservations are a must, so please call us to reserve your seat. It's 212-779-1744. Tickets are $30. It's free for our patients always. For everyone else, it's $30. And it'll be a fun evening.
Yeah, I mean, with so much negative publicity about supplements and herbs lately, we're going to marshal all the evidence that we have been gathering for the past few months that critiques some of these studies and that ties together some of this activity in a pattern of disparagement of the natural products industry. I think you'll find it an interesting evening. And if you're confronting friends, relatives, or health professionals who are telling you that your supplements are worthless, this will be an important opportunity for you to get a different perspective than you might get from, say, the New York Times.
Absolutely. And we're going to make very clear to you the difference between good quality, valid, reliable, scientific science as opposed to any, you know, stuff that doesn't hold water. So junk science is really what we're talking about. And the whole media circus with all of this, what's behind it? We're going to get into all of that.
So that's February 26th,
mm-hmm.
and we're looking very much forward to seeing you all there. With apologies to those of our listeners who are in Kuala Lumpur or Zanzibar or Czechoslovakia, I know you're out there, and you know, we understand. You probably won't be able to hop on a plane and meet us in Midtown Manhattan for that occasion. Thanks very much for joining us. Thank you, Leila. And,
thank you, Dr. Hoff.
We had some interesting questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com gives you an opportunity to have your question answered via intelligent medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.
You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via a convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the intelligent medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or, alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on intelligent medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.